We're doing Parashat Korach, and we had learned how Korach summons 250 people against Moshe, and Moshe challenges them with something that should have scared them, and that even Aaron's own children didn't get away with this, with the two pans offering, the machtos, and they're unrelenting. And we have a tradition that On ben Pelet, his wife saved him. So that's very interesting that Korach's wife spurred him on. She's the one that got him to start this whole fight. And On ben Pelet's wife, she told him, hey, what you fighting for? If Moshe's the boss, you're not. If Korach's the boss, you're not. You don't gain anything by this fight. So why? So he said, yeah, but I promised them I'd be with them tomorrow morning. So she said, you go back to bed and I'll take care of everything. And when they came, She gave them the impression that she was doing her hair and getting ready to be intimate with them, and that they all felt it was immodest to come to the tent, and that much decency they had. So by the time he woke up, Korach was dead, the 250 people were dead, the whole story was over. So Moshe turns to Hashem and says, I haven't taken a thing from them. I've never hurt any of them. So don't accept their offering. And this is interesting because this indicates that the 250 people were innocent. They really intended for the sake of heaven. They were misled, they were misguided, but they meant for the sake of heaven. That's why Moshe prays, don't accept their offering, because their offering has the power to affect the heavens, to represent them. They mean for the sake of heaven. They're making a mistake. And this is a very important point. I'm about to tell you a secret that most people don't realize. And it's a secret that if applied correctly, has tremendous potential for good and for bad. And once you know it, it's your responsibility to use it for good. If you look at world history, you notice that masses can be swayed. If you look at Jewish history, you notice that masses can be swayed. Be it the Meraglim, 10 leaders can turn the hearts of the masses. Be it the Egel, be it when we're standing at the foot of the Yamsuf, be it over here, Korach can sway everyone. Later on, we see the same thing. King Saul becomes king, and the masses turn against him. King David becomes king, and the masses turn against him. Every rebellion, they're siding with the rebellious one. How come? Because Moshe is doing what's right. So he's not focused on being a good politician, getting everyone to love him. He's focused on moving in the right direction. Someone said in the ECB, all the politicians of the euro know what they have to do in order to rescue the euro. The issue is none of them know how to do it and get elected again next election. So when you're a politician who has to ensure that everyone loves you, then you got problems. Moshe is focused on doing what's right. But Korach doesn't have to be. So Korach can win people over. David's focused on doing what's right. But Avshalom doesn't have to be. Avshalom's trying to lead a rebellion against his father David. So he wins over the people. And what we see is that the masses can be swayed, and the one who sways them is not necessarily the tzaddik. So where do you come in? Your job is to do what's right. You will be a part of a community. And I've seen many communities where someone gets up and says, for the sake of heaven, we have to go against the rabbi. For the sake of heaven, we have to get a better rabbi. For the sake of heaven, we have to move the community forward. You know what? In most instances, the people themselves, when they look back, they say, why did I partake of that? But by the time they realize it, they've already done a lot of harm to themselves, to the rabbi, to the community, to their children. So this is something that happens over and over again, and people always present themselves as doing things l'shem shamayim. But remember, the masses can be swayed. And unfortunately, this concept can be used to the detriment of Klal Yisrael, the way Korach did, the way Avshalom did. But this concept can also be used for the betterment of Klal Yisrael. You live in a community, you should know. The fact that they don't have a shear is because you didn't initiate it. You don't have to be the one giving the shear. But you could be the one that tells other people, hey, how come we don't have a shear here? How come Tuesday nights we sit and watch the baseball game? Why don't we get together and get a shear? We each chip in 10 shekel and we have a beer and popcorn. And we could have a nice shear together at my house, at your house. There are many actions. There are many potentials for good. And all they need is that little bit of pepper that'll get people moving. And people don't move. People remain static. Hey, and people don't initiate. And you guys can initiate. So what this parsha teaches us is how we can be a force that propels many people. Look, you wake up in the morning, if you turn on the radio at 6:01 here in Israel, you know what you hear? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, with Hashem's name, Hashem Echad, Ve'avta et Hashem Elokecha. 6:01, every morning. Why is that so? Because there's a beautiful person named Rav Kitzis who said, it cannot be that Israeli radio does not begin with Shema Yisrael. And he started writing letters. He was a Rav who taught in the Michlala, a very, very sweet person. And he started writing letters and pleading, and he won. And for decades now, every morning, the radio here starts with Shema Yisrael. Regular radio, Channel 1, the regular Gal Galatz, the army radio.
But how do you make the decision whether it's proper to say something or not? I know recently there was a woman who wanted to do something in counteraction to the Women of the Wall. I think she was on Yishuv, Kofariyako. And apparently many people, after what happened on that day, just came, ripped her apart. And she said, I wanted to do something that I thought was for the good of the community. So how do you stand up when everyone else is saying one thing? How do you know you're right and they're not, or they are?
Well, you can take counsel with the Rav. There are many things that a Rav can't do. There are many things that have to start grassroots. They have to start from below. People came to me 2 years ago and asked me to start a certain shiur. And I said, I can't. Why? Because if I start it, then I'm pleading with the people and they're doing me a favor by coming to the shiur. If you start it, you get the people to come. And then they come and ask for the shear, then they'll realize that I'm doing them a favor to come and give the shear, and then the shear takes on a different flavor. But if I'm pleading, so every time they come, they're doing the rabbi a favor. I said to them, I'm with you, I'll help you behind the scenes, but you have to initiate it. The people have to want it. Go talk to your friends, get it moving. So there are many things that if started from below, they'll succeed. If you start from above, it doesn't work. And in every community, you need a few people like that who push for the good. And these people, their merits are tremendous. The Talmud tells us, Gadol hame'aseh yoter min ha'oseh. Gadol hame'aseh. He who causes others to do is greater than ha'oseh, than the one who does himself. And this is quoted in Halacha, in Hilchos Tzedakah. So, Hashem appears the next morning. Hashem's cloud appears. And Korach and his men are standing strong. Hashem tells Moshe and Aaron, separate yourself from this congregation. I'll consume them. I'll destroy them in a second. And they both started praying. They threw themselves on the ground. And they said, God, you know what's really going on here. You know what people are thinking. You know that there was one person who really caused all of this. You don't have to punish everyone. And Hashem says, okay, tell everyone to distance themselves from Korach, Dothan, and Aviram, from their camp. And Moshe warns them. He says, pull away from these wicked people. Don't touch anything they own. You don't want to be dragged down with them. And Dothan and Aviram came out blaspheming. And that's what we discussed yesterday, that Moshe saw through all of it. Moshe said, your argument isn't with us. You have an issue with God. You're letting it out on us, but your real issue is with God. And that's what comes out the next morning. Dothan and Aviram come out blaspheming them, their wives, their children. And Moshe says, now you're going to know that God sent me to do what I did here, that I didn't initiate anything on my own. If they die a natural death, even if they drop dead now, I'm a liar. But if something new happens, if the earth opens its mouth up and swallows them, and they go down to their grave alive, if they get swallowed alive, then you'll know that they cursed in their arguments. And he finishes speaking, and the ground opens up under them, and swallows them and their houses, and everyone who was with them, and all their wealth, and they go down, and then the ground closes up. And everyone ran. Have you guys ever been around during an earthquake? It's a very scary thing to feel the ground under you move.
I think you heard some noise or something. It
is written. You're right. It says there was a tremendous noise. And that's what they ran away from. Right? It says, Nasu lekolam. But that noise could be understood as their wails as they went down. They started wailing and their wails could be heard, and that was scary, and everyone ran away.
Why did they take down their houses? Because there were 250 individuals.
No, so the 250, they didn't. The 250 were killed by fire. Dothan, Aviram, Korach, and their families, that's what was swallowed when the ground opened up. The 250 people were killed by fire. So, now we have an interesting thing. Hashem says, take these people's pans and I want you to coat the Mizbeach with them, because the people really did dedicate it for Hashem, and this will be a sign for Am Yisrael to remember what happened. We have to ask ourselves, what's going on here? The pasuk seems to indicate that Hashem says it's very possible the same thing will happen a second time.
This wasn't the first time. I mean, Nadab and Abihu was the first time when they go inside ground. There's some. Here is the second, and after the Meraglim, they go down. Rebellion after rebellion.
What? I don't know. I think the stress over here is it's a sign that there's a hierarchy, and just because a person wants to enter the holies doesn't mean he can. And that concept, you would think, after such a great miracle like Korach, the people would get the hint. And you see that Hashem's approach is very different. This is a way of ensuring that people remember it. And that teaches us something about how people have a tendency to forget. Even if they learned the lesson, they have a tendency to forget. And then repeat the same errors that previous generations made. And so you have a special command by Hashem, code it and let people see. And this will be a sign for them. We delude ourselves. Very often we like to think everyone understands. I remember when the Oslo Peace Accords blew up. So everyone was saying, now everyone understands. You had a lot of leftists who said they're turning right. And then when Barak's Accords blew up, they said, everyone understands. And you had people from the left shifting right again. And again, you had everyone saying, everyone knows you don't have a partner for peace. And each time, and then when they said they're declaring a state, so people said, now everyone understands. They went against even the most basic thing in the Oslo Accords. Of course, everyone understands you can't make peace with them. No. You know, Wherever there's a temptation to take a different approach, so the temptation is ever present. And it could be for a year or two or three, people will view things differently, but then they'll shift back. So here there's a temptation, and we see throughout the period of the Second Temple, people bought their way into the temple. People who were unfitting, people who really did not belong in the temple as Kohanim Gdolim, got into the temple. They bought their way in through the emperor. So this is a big temptation. And Hashem says, no, you can't just come in because you want to. You have to be fit for it. So they do as they're told. They coat the altar with these pans. And that's supposed to be commemoration, that people will remember that a stranger who is not a descendant of Aaron will not come in to offer the Ketores. And there should never be a repeat of Korach. According to the Rambam, this is a promise that there will never be a repeat of Korach. No one will question Moshe's prophecy. The very next morning, Am Yisrael comes and complains and says, you killed those 250 people. What a large contingency were killed. And it's all your fault. We understand Dasan and Aviram, they sinned. But 250 people died like Nadav and Avihu. You see, they were holy. So you, why'd you do that? Boom. God's cloud appears. And Hashem says, okay. So the nation stands with them. They're siding with them. So step away and I'll destroy them. And Moshe sends Aaron with the frying pan, with that pan, with the incense and Ketores. And he says, go, because you have to atone, because Ketzef has gone out from before Hashem. So the simple understanding is Ketzef is anger. Chazal tell us that there are angels of destruction that have different names. One of them is called Ketzef. Ketzef is one of the names of anger. There's Charon, there's Af, there's Ketzef, there's Chema. So Ketzef went out. And Aaron runs with the pan, and people are dropping like flies. And 14,000 people have died. 14,700. And then Aaron comes back, and the plague has stopped. So here we have a Medrash. You guys saw the Medrash Rashi quotes? Rashi quotes that Aaron went, it was as though you had a wave passing through and people were dropping. And Aaron caught up with the wave and started going just where the wave was about to hit people. So he's standing between those that are dead and those that are alive. And Chazal say that he grabbed the angel and made him stand his ground. So the angel said, let me go. I got to do my job. And Aaron says, no, Moshe sent me to stop you. So the angel says, God sent me and you're being sent by Moshe. So let me do what God told me to do and get out of my way. So Aaron said, no, because Moshe doesn't invent anything. If Moshe sent me, then obviously God told him to send me. And if you don't believe me, the Ribon Shalom and Moshe are both at the entrance to the tent, right? Moshe's talking to God right there. Come with me and let's go ask them. And that's why the Parsha concludes with Aaron's return to Moshe at the entrance of Ohel Moed. Because, so to speak, he forced the angel to come back with him. And then, obviously, the plague stopped because Moshe didn't invent his own thing. We're at Chamishi and we have a commandment to take a staff from each of the leaders. And Hashem says, I want to prove to them that I've chosen you and Aaron, and Aaron and his tribe have their job, and this way we will remove the claims. They put all the staffs, and of course Moshe is careful to put Aaron's staff in the middle, because if Aaron's staff would be too much to the right, they'd say it's because it was to the right, that's where things flourish. And if it were to the left, they say it was to the left, that's why. So that's why Moshe is careful. And this is a concept we see time and again, where we would say, stop being so small-minded, come on, this is petty. No, the Torah says, if these are the claims people make, so then God takes the time to answer those claims as well. And we see this concept with Avram and Yitzchak. Here, Avram can't have kids all the years, and Sarah can't have kids all the years. And then God promises him he'll have a child. He has a child, and people start saying, ooh, it must be from Avimelech. So God makes it that Yitzchak looks identical to Avram in order to answer those claims. And we see this many times in the Torah, that God, so to speak, goes out of his way to answer up any claim that one might have. So Aaron's staff has flourished. It's produced almonds. And Hashem tells Moshe, leave Aaron's staff inside the Holy of Holies. Again, that will be testimony that they should stop complaining, I chose Aaron. And that's what Moshe does. Now, Am Yisrael says, we can't handle all this holiness. So many people are dropping dead around the Holy of Holies. We can't handle it. And again, you see the masses going from side to side. First, everyone wants to enter, and then everyone wants out. Everyone says, we can't handle this. And then Hashem gives them the responsibility of the temple and the responsibility of ensuring the temple remains pure, which is no easy thing, because you're talking about the top tourist attraction in Judaism. But they have a responsibility to ensure that the temple or the Mishkan remain pure. And they have the Levites who are playing a supportive role. And then the parasha concludes with the mitzvos that Aaron was given, the different matnos kehuna, the different gifts that a kohen is entitled to. And that's there are different midrashim as to why these. You could hear it in previous years. We went through it. At the very end of the parasha says, when you take off the tithe, take off chelbo. And here we have a halachic concept that the things that are taken off in honor of Hashem should be like chelev. They should be the chosen parts. Very often, a person feels like he has an old car, let him donate it to the shul. He has an old talis, let him donate it to the shul. So there's a beautiful story about the Gera Rebbe, that he had a pair of tefillin that was written by a super holy scribe, and the grandchildren were already talking which grandson would get those tefillin. And then they all said, there's one grandson who's his top grandson, undoubtedly he will get those tefillin. Now the Gera Rebbe would only wear those tefillin on special occasion. He'd wear it in Elul, in the first 10 days of Tishrei. He'd wear it in special occasions. So one day the grandson is visiting, and he says, Saba, I don't see the tefillin. Where are the special tefillin? There were the tefillin that Ger Rebbe wore every day. And then in a special place on the bookcase, they had those special tefillin. So his grandfather says, a poor man came here the other day, and he didn't have a pair of tefillin, so I gave him those. So the grandson is destroyed. He says, but why those? You have your regular pair of tefillin. If you felt you have to give him a pair, give him your regular one. So the grandfather, the Ger Rebbe, looks at him and says, when we do a mitzvah, we do it with the best that we own, not the worst that we own. The best that we own. So that was the best pair of tefillin I had. So that's what we do a mitzvah with. So that's the idea, chelbo. The Torah says, take your best. And you'll be surprised. There are little pairs of eyes that are watching us with everything we do. And when we sit and we do a benching like this, so our little children are looking at us and they're learning what value we give benching. And when we go out to buy them their tefillin for the bar mitzvah, so I had a neighbor, I was still a kid when this story happened. The neighbor came by to borrow something and he was schmoozing with my father. And he said, you know, when I was bar mitzvah, my dad took me down to the Lower East Side to buy me a pair of tefillin. And I'll never forget it. There he was, standing with the scribe, haggling over my pair of tefillin. And I stood there as a kid and I wondered, the mitzvah is so precious. Why are you trying to save a dollar on a precious mitzvah? And it still stays with me that my father wanted to save a dollar on how I performed the mitzvah of tefillin. So the father saved a dollar. But the impact on the kid, decades later, was still there. So we have to think sometimes, what message are we giving the kids? And it's important sometimes to spell it out, because children don't know it on their own. We once had a dentist appointment for one of the boys, and it would have been much easier to leave them home from the morning till the dentist appointment, and then either bring them back to school or not. And I told my wife, do me a favor, pay the extra money, take a taxi, pick him up from school and bring him back. And the kid didn't understand, why are we doing that? So I said to him, look, the story of Yaakov Avinu with the sheep and Lavan and how the sheep got mixed and this type of sheep and that type of sheep, you don't know it well. You have a Chamisha Chumshei Torah, you know the whole Torah, except for that parsha. So he said, you're right. How do you know? I said, because I reviewed with you what you learned. And that week you were sick. And we were never able to make it up well. And I saw that as much as I try explaining it to you, I don't do as good a job as your Rebbe. So you know the rest of the Torah, and there's one parsha which I know you don't know, because you were sick the week your class learned it, and I was never able to make it up to you. So I learned that your Rebbe does a really good job teaching you the stories of the Torah. And that's why it's worth it to us to pay. It's a lot of money. To pay the money to travel, turn off, pick you up, take you to Ramot to the dentist and bring you back, but minimize the amount of time you lose because I see you're making good use of your time. Now, we could have done the same thing without explaining it to him because on principle, we thought it was right. But once it was explained to him, so then he looks at his time differently. He looks at his learning differently. He says, oh, okay, I'm doing something important here. My parents value what I'm doing. They're willing to invest in it. So that in order for the message to come alive, we have to spell it out to the kids sometimes. They won't necessarily see it on their own.